All right, welcome everyone. Ready for another deep dive? Today, we're going to untangle a case that really flipped the script on how states have to handle appeals for indigent defendants, you know, those who can't afford a lawyer, specifically appeals after they've already pled guilty. We're talking about Halbert v. Michigan, a 2005 Supreme Court showdown that left a lasting impact on criminal justice and the whole concept of appellate rights.
Yeah, it's a big one for sure. I mean, at the heart of it, this case grapples with this huge question, right? Does the 14th Amendment, with its guarantees of due process and equal protection, force states to provide lawyers for those who can't afford them when they're trying to appeal after taking a plea deal? Supreme Court ultimately said yes, but it wasn't a slam dunk. The dissent and the whole journey to that decision reveal some really interesting, almost philosophical tensions about how we view justice, especially at the appellate level.
Absolutely. And for those of you in law school listening in, this is a case that goes way beyond just memorizing a citation. It dives into the depths of what the right to counsel actually means in practice and how we balance the state's need for a legal system that runs smoothly with the absolute necessity of fairness for everyone, rich or poor.
Couldn't agree more.
So let's back up for a second and set the stage. Why did this case even land in the Supreme Court's lap? What was going on in Michigan that sparked this whole legal battle?
Well, it all started back in 1994. That's when Michigan decided to shake things up with their constitution, specifically when it came to appeals. They took away the automatic right to appeal for defendants convicted after pleading guilty or no contest, what we call nolo contendere. From that point on, if you wanted to appeal, you had to ask the court for permission. For what they call leave to appeal.
Yeah.
The court basically got to decide whether your case was even worth hearing at the next level. So no more guaranteed appeals in those circumstances.
Interesting. So basically, the default became no appeal unless a higher court decided to take a look. Okay, that helps explain how we get to Antonio Halbert. Can you tell us about his situation and how he got tangled up in this new system?
Right. So Halbert, he enters a plea of nolo contender to two counts of criminal sexual conduct there in Michigan. Now, for those who may not be totally familiar with the term, nolo contender basically translates to no contest. It's treated like a guilty plea when it comes to sentencing, but the defendant isn't actually saying, I did it. It's more like saying, I'm not fighting this. Anyway, at his sentencing, Halbert starts raising concerns, saying there were mistakes in his case, that his trial lawyer wasn't effective, you know, typical things you might raise on appeal, and he asked the court to appoint him a lawyer to help with that appeal. But because of Michigan's new rule, his request was denied.
Oh, I see where this is going. So he's essentially saying, hey, something went wrong here. My lawyer wasn't up to par. And Michigan's response is, well, you pleaded no contest, so too bad. No automatic appeal for you. And we're not giving you a lawyer for something that might not even get heard. That's got to be an incredibly tough spot for someone without legal knowledge to be in. Like, how are you supposed to navigate that system on your own?
Exactly. It puts defendants in a really difficult position. Without legal training, understanding all the ins and outs of appeals, and knowing how to even articulate legal errors is a massive, massive obstacle. So Halbert, without a lawyer, tries to file his own appeal, going pro se, as we say in the legal world. But both the trial court and the Michigan Court of Appeals shot him down. They basically said, nope, your arguments aren't strong enough for us to review this further. And that's when the case makes its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. It was clear there was a huge disagreement about constitutional rights at play here.
Right. This wasn't just about one guy's appeal. It was about a fundamental conflict in how we understand the right to counsel, especially in the context of appeals after a guilty plea. So at the heart of it, the big question the Supreme Court had to wrestle with was whether the 14th Amendment, specifically its due process and equal protection clauses, actually requires states to provide lawyers to people who can't afford them when they want to appeal a conviction that came after they pled guilty. Now, to really grasp the court's thinking here, we need to rewind a bit and look at some earlier Supreme Court decisions that set the stage for this debate. And those are, of course, Douglas v. California and Ross v. Moffitt. Can you give us a rundown on those?
Absolutely. Those two cases really laid the groundwork for how the court approached Halbert. So first up, Douglas v. California, which came out in 1963. In Douglas, the Supreme Court was very clear. States must provide a lawyer to indigent defendants for their first appeal, the one they automatically get as a matter of right. The logic there was that a first appeal is such a crucial stage in the process that not having a lawyer to argue your case effectively could seriously disadvantage a poor defendant, basically creating an unequal playing field compared to someone who could afford a lawyer. You know, it just wouldn't be fair.
That makes sense. Everyone should have a fair shot at having their conviction reviewed, at least that first time around, regardless of how much money they have. Okay, so that's Douglas. What about Ross v. Moffitt? It came about 10 years later in 1974 and took a different stance on this right to counsel on appeal, right?
Yeah, so in Ross, the court basically said that states don't have to provide a lawyer for appeals that are considered discretionary. Like, if you're appealing to a state Supreme Court or all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, those are seen as optional appeals. The thinking there was, by the time a case gets that high, you've already had an appeal with a lawyer to help you out. That initial review with counsel is considered the most critical point for catching and fixing any errors. And appeals to those higher courts often deal with even more complex legal issues, so the courts can usually just work with the arguments that have already been made.
So we have these two big precedents, one saying a lawyer is required for the first appeal, and the other saying it's not required for appeals that are kind of like bonus rounds. And that's exactly where the tension lies in Halbert. Michigan's leave to appeal system for cases stemming from pleas wasn't technically an appeal as of right, which makes it seem more like the discretionary appeals in Ross. But it was also the first time a court would be looking at a conviction that came from a plea. So, which case applies? It's a tough call.
Right. Which rule wins out? That was the core issue. And in a 6-3 decision written by Justice Ginsburg, the Supreme Court sided with Halbert, ruling that Michigan did have to provide a lawyer in these specific cases. Their reasoning really boiled down to a few key points.
Okay, let's break those down. What was so special about these plea-based appeals that convinced the majority to side with Halbert?
Well, the first big thing was this. For defendants convicted after taking a plea deal, the decision by the Michigan Court of Appeals on whether to grant leave to appeal, to even hear the appeal, that was the first and probably the only direct review that conviction and sentence would get. They basically drew a big line between this initial check and the truly optional appeals in Ross, where there had already been a chance for an appeal with a lawyer. So even though Michigan called it discretionary, the Supreme Court said, hold on, in practice, this is the main way these cases get reviewed.
So they looked beyond the label and focused on how the system actually worked for defendants who took pleas. That makes sense. What else swayed their thinking?
They were also really concerned about the hurdles faced by people trying to navigate this complex legal maze without a lawyer. You know, those pro-C folks we mentioned before, they talk about how complicated Michigan's sentencing laws are and how many defendants might not have much education or even the mental capacity to fully grasp what's happening. The court basically said, without a lawyer, how can these individuals possibly present their claims effectively, especially when it comes to things like errors in sentencing or arguments about ineffective assistance of counsel?
Right. It's almost like asking someone who's never played baseball to suddenly step up to bat in the World Series. They're just not equipped to compete on that level. What about Michigan's argument, though? They claim that by taking a plea, Halbert had basically given up his right to a lawyer on appeal. How did the court address that?
The court shut that down pretty quickly. They pointed out that Michigan's law about not providing lawyers for appeals after pleas, that law came after Halbert had already entered his plea. You can't waive a right that didn't even exist when you made your plea, right? On top of that, they highlighted that some of the biggest issues someone might raise on appeal after taking a plea, things like sentencing problems or claiming their lawyer's bad advice led them to plead in the first place, those things often come up after the plea is done.
Okay, so the majority's opinion seems rooted in this idea of making sure there's a real chance for an initial appeal, especially since this leave to appeal process was often the only shot these defendants had at having their cases looked at again. So we've got the majority's take. Now, let's flip the coin and see what the dissent had to say. What arguments did Justice Thomas and the other justices who disagreed with the majority put forward?
All right, so Justice Thomas, and he had Justices Scalia and Rehnquist backing him up on some points, he came out swinging with a pretty strong counterargument. Their main point was that Michigan's system wasn't actually violating the Equal Protection Clause. They argued that the state had good reason to treat appeals after trials differently from appeals that come after a plea. Their logic was cases that are wrapped up with a plea deal tend to be less complicated. Plus, the defendant has already made a choice to admit guilt or at least not fight the charges. So they saw that plea as a big difference that justified a different way of handling appeals.
Okay, so they're basically saying the plea itself changes the game, making an automatic appeal and a free lawyer less necessary. Interesting. What else did they bring up?
Yeah, they lean pretty heavily on this concept of waiver. They said that when someone pleads guilty or no contest, they automatically give up certain rights, including the right to the same level of appeal as someone who went through a whole trial. They felt that Halbert knew what he was doing when he entered his plea and should accept the consequences that came with it. And they also, you know, tossed in some concerns about federalism, that whole idea of states' rights. They basically accused the Supreme Court of overstepping and meddling with the state's right to run their own courts how they see fit.
That classic tension between federal power and states' rights, always a hot topic. So beyond just the legal arguments, what practical effects did Halbert have? Did it actually change how things work in the real world?
Absolutely. The most immediate impact was that states that had systems like Michigan's, where appeals after pleas were restricted, well, they had to start providing lawyers to those who couldn't afford them if they wanted to appeal. So that likely meant a whole lot more work for public defenders and private attorneys who take court appointments.
Yeah.
Suddenly, they had a bunch of appeals to handle that they might not have had before.
Makes sense. That's a pretty direct consequence for the legal profession and the resources needed to actually make these appeals happen. But zooming out a bit, what bigger message did Halbert send about how our justice system is supposed to function? What does it say about our values?
To me, Halbert is a really powerful reminder that access to justice is supposed to be a core value of our legal system. Even though the vast majority of criminal cases end with plea deals, this decision shows that those convictions still deserve proper review. It's a win for fairness, making sure that even those who plead guilty get a real opportunity to challenge any potential problems in their cases through the appellate process. And having a lawyer is a huge part of that. It shines a light on how plea bargains, though efficient, might not truly represent informed and voluntary choices if the defendant doesn't fully grasp what they're giving up, especially when it comes to appeals.
That's a great point. It makes you think about the trade-offs we make in the name of efficiency and whether those trade-offs always align with our ideals of justice. So, as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave everyone with something to chew on. Think about this. Was the Supreme Court majority in Halbert mainly motivated by a desire to level the playing field for poor defendants, recognizing how complex the legal system is and how easy it is to get lost in it without a guide? Or were they more focused on strictly following procedure, essentially saying that this leave to appeal process was the same as a first appeal, no matter what you call it? And knowing how strongly the dissent felt, do you think states might try to find creative ways to reshape their appeal systems in response to this decision? Maybe to comply with the ruling while still trying to manage their resources. It's a question worth pondering as you continue exploring the world of law.
Definitely. And maybe another thing to think about is how plea bargaining itself is changing and how that intersects with these appellate rights. As more and more cases get resolved through pleas, how will the principles set out in Halbert shape our understanding of due process and the need for effective legal representation at every step, even after someone waives their right to a trial? It really raises questions about the true meaning of a plea and whether it's really a knowing and voluntary waiver of rights if you don't understand the full picture, especially when it comes to what happens after the plea is entered. Food for thought as you continue your legal journey.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, everyone. Until next time.
Thanks for having me.